Welcome to Pro Se, Law 360's weekly podcast. I'm your host, Amber McKinney, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Alex Lawson.
Hello to you both. Great to be back.
And Haley Knopf.
Hey, hey. I have a question for you guys.
Okay.
Have you seen Saltburn yet?
Oh, I have been told it's great, but not yet.
No, my wife did, and she came back and she had some serious takes. I have not seen it myself. I was intrigued to learn that it is, I did not know this about it. I know about the movie, but I did not know that it was a period piece from 2006.
Oh, yes, it was, Alex.
Wait. Guys.
Yeah, sorry, Amber, spoiler alert. Yeah.
As the oldest person on this call, can we not call it a period piece from that era?
I mean,
Amber,
that feels sad.
That offends our sensibilities as well. When I saw it referred to in this manner, I was like, well, 2006 was what, 2 years ago?
No, I mean, it's just, all I mean by that is that it's not taking place contemporaneously. And I say it with sincerity because I was in college in 2006. And when I say, again, I didn't see the film, but my wife immediately pulled up the soundtrack.
Yep.
Which was
I was about to say.
Yeah. Like
bangers. You
know, the MGMT.
It transports you right back.
Oh, sure. Okay.
There's like MG. There's like a lot of blog rock. What else was on there? It was like, there was like a, was there like a Stroke song or something or some other thing?
So basically I'm going to
love all of that. There was some Get Low.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, Petey Pablo. Yeah. But why do you bring it up, Haley?
Well, I bring it up because we're not in the business of any spoilers on this show, but there are some loose legal themes.
Oh, wow.
So if you were on the fence about seeing it, I would see it just to be a part of the discourse, to be honest, because the discourse is robust. I lost sleep going through Letterboxd takes on Tuesday after I saw it. So,
oh, well, I love that. I mean, the legal stuff also intrigues me, but that is enough for me, Haley. You know I want to be part of that sweet, sweet discourse.
See it for the jams. See it for the loose legal themes. And also see it because I want to discuss it with you both after you've seen it.
Also, I do want to correct myself. Petey Pablo did not do Low. That's, of course, Flo Rida and T-Pain.
Oh, yes.
Oh, you're so right.
I misspoke. I was thinking of Freak-a-Leak, which is from when I was high school, not
this
in college.
This seems the point where I should move us on to some other legal news.
Yeah,
we're
right,
now
fine,
just talking
fine.
About
Thank
jams.
You.
Please.
I do have a little bit of an update. So
we
had talked on the podcast in the past about Alec Murdoch, who was convicted of murdering his wife and son. Pretty salacious story that was all over the news. We did discuss that, though. And I do have a bit of an update here. He was sentenced on Tuesday to 27 years in prison for stealing $12.4 million from his law firm partners and clients and also evading taxes. So this is obviously not salacious in the same way as murder, which is much more serious.
He is a convicted murderer, yes.
But this is a pretty big white-collar crime and punishment here, and just another button on that story. So I did want to flag it. We have some really good coverage of it if people want to come on over to law360.com.
Yeah, it isn't every day that the white-collar sentences are this hefty, for sure.
No, for sure. It's sort of an interesting financial crime update to that. Quite salacious story, as you say, Amber. As for the show this week, I would encourage everybody to stick around because in just a few minutes, you'll hear a conversation that I had with our own senior competition reporter, Brian Koenig. And he wrote about this trend that's been going on the last couple years in the DOJ's antitrust division, where they had made a point to criminally prosecute no poach cases, these cases between where you allege that companies are agreeing not to poach one another's workers or agree to suppress wages to stifle employee movement. It was basically a very aggressive push on like labor side antitrust enforcement rather than like consumer side or like, you know, price fixing, things like that, which we often associate with antitrust. But that has run into a lot of problems. There was a very kind of low-key dismissal earlier this week. They've taken several losses at the trial level in the last couple of years. And Brian is all over that stuff. And it was quite an interesting discussion. So I would encourage everybody to stick around for that. But we do have some news to get to first. And Haley, I will kick it to you.
Folks, we are talking forever chemicals again. PFAS, baby. As you may recall, litigation over alleged contamination from PFAS has been everywhere, and 3M in particular has taken some big L's. In June, it agreed to shell out $12.5 billion to end litigation, alleging that its firefighting foam leached chemicals into public drinking water systems. And we talked about that in episode 304, if you want to revisit it. But now the Sixth Circuit has handed 3M and a handful of other chemical companies a big win in a separate case. It decertified a massive class of 11 million Ohio residents who claimed the companies put their health at risk by manufacturing and selling products with these chemicals. The panel also instructed the lower court to throw out the case altogether. So, big win.
Yeah, I want to get into that. And not to back us up too much, but could you give me a little reminder about these forever chemicals and kind of how we got here?
Absolutely. So PFAS stands for per- and polyfluorical substances. They're known as forever chemicals because they linger in the environment for a very long time. They can be found in drinking water, groundwater, surface water, soil, air, fish, plants. Basically, close your eyes and point at something.
And you will find a forever chemical. You will find your forever chemical.
Much
like when you're like shopping for a house or dating somebody.
You
find your forever chemical. Yeah.
They
lingered. Yeah, to your point.
Yes. So in this case, an Ohio firefighter, his name is Kevin Hardwick, claimed that he was exposed to PFAS in foams and contaminated equipment and gear that he used on the job. And he said amounts of the forever chemicals have been found in his blood, and that puts him at a higher risk of disease.
Well, that's a very colorful and quite striking allegation from this former firefighter, but you did mention this was a certified class of 11 million people, which I would imagine encompassed various different circumstances. What was that class looking like? It's now been undone, but I do want, and we'll get to that, I suppose, but I do want to talk about like exactly what was covered in that 11 million strong class certification.
Yeah, because you can't imagine those are all like firefighters.
Well, right, yeah.
No, yeah, that 11 million was basically everyone in the state of Ohio.
Right.
I will also note that Hardwick had initially wanted a certified nationwide class that encompassed basically everyone in the United States. 330 million Americans who've
been
exposed to PFAS. Yeah, all of us. But the Ohio federal court overseeing his case shot that down and instead agreed to certify just the Ohio class. And specifically, that class included any person subject to Ohio laws with a blood concentration of 0.5 parts per trillion of any PFAS. So stopped short of his initial request, but still, you know, the whole state of Ohio is certainly something.
11 million people in a class action is not nothing, but...
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and at the time, I do want to get into a little bit of the judge's reasoning here because the Sixth Circuit then really tore it apart. So the Ohio federal judge said that Hardwick had standing to bring these claims under Article 3 because he adequately alleged an injury in fact from the increased risk of disease from the chemical exposures. And the judge also found that Hardwick alleged an injury that was indeed traceable to 3M and the other defendant companies. And he had established the likelihood of redressability, which in this case meant that Hardwick had argued that his alleged injuries could be tackled via medical monitoring for class members.
Okay, but you said that the Sixth Circuit was really having none of this. So what did they rule?
This was a really, for I believe it was like 7 pages long, for such a short order, it was a really entertaining one to read. The Sixth Circuit did not mince words. Yeah. So the big takeaway here is the Sixth Circuit found that Hardwick doesn't have standing to bring these claims. So not only should the class be decertified, but the entire case should be thrown out. The opening sentence of the opinion is very telling. Here's the quote. Seldom is so ambitious a case filed on so slight a basis. And basically,
wow.
Yeah. Basically, the panel said that Hardwick doesn't actually know what companies manufactured the chemicals found in his bloodstream, nor does he know whether those chemicals could one day actually make him sick. The chemicals singled out by Hardwick in his suit are, according to the panel, part of a family of thousands of chemicals whose usage is nearly ubiquitous in modern life. Thousands of companies have been involved in manufacturing that involves PFAS, but Hardwick and his suit chose just to select 10 companies as defendants. And the big problem here, according to the Sixth Circuit, is that Hardwick failed to tie his alleged injury to each defendant individually. So he treated them as a collective, and the Sixth Circuit did not like that. Here's another quote. Nowhere in his complaint did Hardwick allege that any of these defendants, much less every one of them, manufactured any of those five compounds. Nor did he allege any plausible pathway by which any of these defendants could have delivered any of these five PFAS to his bloodstream.
Yeah, I mean, that quote right there from the panel kind of gets to what we were talking about before, not only to the sheer size and numerosity of the class, but also the allegations. I'm curious to know, I mean, we sort of centered the discussion around what Hardwick was alleging about his own circumstance. And of course, when you lodge a class action, you have to allege some commonality. The panel clearly didn't buy it. It's also an interesting example of just a very like firm and like strident rebuke from the appeals panel over what I assume was a pretty carefully considered district court opinion. But
yeah, and in like 7 pages, no less. It took them no time to get there.
Right. And as you said, I mean, it was brief but strong, which is like quite striking to me. But what did Hardwick have to say about this? I mean, this was, you know, he was the progenitor of the lawsuit, and it got a pretty clean rebuke here from the district or from the appellate court, rather.
Hardwick's attorney told me that they are considering their options. That could entail, you know, asking for a rehearing from the panel or rehearing en banc. And then there's also a chance, of course, that this could land before the Supreme Court. So, like I mentioned back in June with that other PFAS litigation, these claims are just everywhere, folks. The settlements are everywhere. Apparently, the certifications, the decertifications are flying. I'm sure this is not the last time we'll be discussing this.
I'd like to pivot us now to another sort of thing that's in the air in 2023. And it's not just chemicals this time.
It's not only chemicals.
That's right. This is about celebrity and the nature of how it works in 2023. It's clear that if you're a celebrity these days, much of your life is in the spotlight all the time. But just how much of your everyday activities are in the public interest? That's the key question unspooling from a lawsuit accusing Lizzo of sexual harassment and other discrimination. Late last week, an attorney for the dancers who are suing Lizzo pushed back against her argument that everything she does is of the public interest and therefore protected speech. This is the same argument Lizzo's attorneys tried with another of their clients, Shia LaBeouf.
Look, celebrities are always advancing creative legal arguments and with varying levels of success. But before we get into the particulars of that argument specifically, I do think we haven't talked about this, but it has been in the news generally. Let's refresh a little bit. What is the case against Lizzo? I know it's brought by some of her former dancers and people who worked on her tours and things like that. What are the allegations? What do we need to know, Amber?
We haven't talked about it because I just took a DNA test and I 100% feel sad about this lawsuit.
So
we kind of didn't talk about it because, I don't know, I'm a plus size girl in America. I think I'm like obligated to have always loved Lizzo. So it's tough when these allegations came out because they are pretty intense. So just in a nutshell, back in August, dancers Ariana Davis, Crystal Williams, and Noel Rodriguez filed a complaint accusing Lizzo, her dance team captain, and her touring team of a slew of illegal actions, including harassment based on religion, sex, and race, and also some disability discrimination related to the weight gain of one of the dancers. So that allegation in particular really flies in the face of Lizzo's personal brand. So that's part of what's going on in the suit. The suit includes some really salacious hostile work environment allegations related to a dance captain who was actually mimicking oral sex on a banana, and then Lizzo allegedly encouraging the crew to participate in sex acts at an Amsterdam red light district club. So it gets pretty intense pretty quickly, what's in this complaint. It was covered extensively. And as I said, really felt like a bummer of a story. I didn't really want to talk about it, but we are at a point now where the legal issues are getting increasingly interesting. So I thought we should bring it to the show.
Yeah, I think we're all wondering how it is that one could invoke protected speech and public interest in a case like this.
Sure. So Lizzo's lawyers filed a motion arguing the case should be dismissed under California's anti-SLAPP statute. That's a law many states have to make it easier to quickly end meritless lawsuits that threaten free speech. It's weird, as you say, Haley, to have an anti-SLAPP motion trying to end a harassment or discrimination suit by a former employee against their employer. That's not typical.
No.
Where we usually see this, and where we've talked about it a bunch on Pro Se, actually, is this kind of thing comes up a lot more in defamation cases, where a defendant argues that some kind of powerful plaintiff is using the courts to silence them. That's when you usually get this anti-SLAPP motion. So during a hearing on Lizzo's motion to strike the complaint from the three dancers, the attorney for those dancers said Lizzo's contention that her celebrity status makes her everyday activities in the public interest has already failed in a California appellate court. The firm representing Lizzo made the same argument in a case involving Shia LaBeouf. In that case, a California appellate court held that the actor calling a bartender a racist in a private dispute did not convert those statements into the type of speech that's entitled to anti-SLAPP protection.
Well, there's something you said about playing the hits, I suppose, if it was the same firm and they tried this and it didn't work and they were like, hey, let's run it back. You know, different facts. Maybe it'll listen. I mean, the whole point of anti-SLAPP laws is to get these lawsuits tossed out quickly with very little hassle. So I do understand the inclination to at least try that, even if it doesn't pass muster. But what exactly were the arguments that Lizzo was making at this stage? I mean, I can get my head around the concept of like, I'm such a huge celebrity that like everything I'm doing at almost any time resides in the public domain, even if it's not like happening in the public domain. But what were the arguments?
Well, before I even touch that, which I will in just a second, Alex, but Lizzo and her team have been very vocal about saying that this is all, you know, untrue. And at one point, they said that the dancers' claims were a fabricated sob story, that they were opportunists, that they were seeking a quick payday. They have not minced words about this at all. They are basically saying, this is all made up. They just want money. So that's sort of, again, the backdrop to the broader suit. Regarding the anti-SLAPP arguments, Lizzo's attorneys have said her level of celebrity has transformed the most mundane aspects of her daily life into those issues of public interest. When asked about that during an argument in front of a judge on this, they basically said her artistic expression encompasses nearly everything she does, including hiring and firing of dancers, holding meetings with those dancers, taking her employees out for team building activities, which allegedly would include going to that Amsterdam red light district club. So even that, they contend, is part of her broader artistic expression, that it all feeds into that. That would mean that all of the incidents alleged in the complaint are part of Lizzo's artistic expression and are therefore subject to anti-SLAPP protection. Meanwhile, the dancer's attorney pointed to some case law where the California Supreme Court held that CNN can't use laws protecting free speech to escape claims it engaged in age and race discrimination against a producer. So that seems a little more analogous fact-wise to what's being alleged in this Lizzo case. We don't have a ruling on this yet. We've had coverage of it, and this is like a bubbling up issue. It is still being considered by the court. But I wanted to bring it up because it does add this additional wrinkle to an already highly watched case. And I think it just puts an additional spotlight on this one, not just for salacious facts, but for an area of the law that hasn't been fully fleshed out here. So we may get some interesting case law out of the Lizzo dispute.
The Justice Department's years-long push to crack down on companies colluding to not compete for certain employees appears to be taking a step back, as the DOJ's antitrust division quietly dropped a case against a United Healthcare unit earlier this month, the latest in a series of losses and retreats in the push against so-called no-poach agreements. The gradual decline of those efforts and the DOJ's failure to convince a single jury to convict on any labor-related antitrust criminal charges has left the competition bar wondering what's next. And we're joined this week by Law 360 senior reporter Brian Koenig to unpack it all. Welcome back to the show, Brian.
Glad to be here.
All right, so let's take a broad look at what we're talking about here. So we're talking antitrust. You've been on the show before to talk about antitrust, but we're specifically talking about antitrust in the labor context against these, as I said, no-poach agreements. When did that push really begin in earnest, and what has the DOJ generally argued in these cases?
Yeah, it goes back to 2016 when the DOJ Antitrust Division and the Federal Trade Commission issued joint guidance for HR professionals saying that they could potentially treat these kinds of deals as criminally anti-competitive because they can go after violations of agreements and restraint of trade civilly and have against these kinds of no-poach and similar deals civilly for years and years, but only in 2016 did they say these also could face criminal penalties, which means steeper fines for companies and prison time for company executives. After a couple of years of waiting, they finally started filing those cases in late 2020. And as you mentioned, the prosecutions have been going very badly. They've gotten a pair of guilty pleas, which with one company and one executive, that resulted in about $100,000 worth of fines and probation. No one has gone to prison for these charges. Their only conviction from a jury has been from lying to FTC investigators in an earlier investigation of the same conduct. No one has been convicted, and certainly no one has gone to prison on the actual labor side antitrust violations. Every time those charges have reached a jury, the jury has acquitted. And in one particular case, when it got to a judge in Connecticut, the judge had trial in front of the jury, but the judge threw it out under Rule 29 of criminal procedure, saying that no reasonable jury could convict at all on those charges.
Well, let's dive into that a little further. I mean, we're talking to you now because there was sort of a quiet dismissal this week, and I'm curious to know, or rather earlier this month, and I'm kind of curious to see where that fits in with this kind of broader trend of these cases kind of stalling out. Can you talk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, and these charges generally target two different kinds of agreements. There's non-solicitation or no-poach deals where employer A and employer B turn to each other and say, you won't hire my workers, I won't hire yours. And then there's wage fixing, which is maybe a little more traditional, where company A and company B turn to each other and say, okay, we're going to cap people at $50,000 a year. We're not going to pay them a penny more. Yes. So if an employee at company A is unhappy, they can't turn to company B to try and either get a better paying position or leverage an offer from company B to get a higher salary where they currently are.
Yeah, sort of two ways of doing the same thing. You either agree not to hire, or you just enter into a wage ceiling amongst yourselves. Yeah.
Yeah. And this last case, tossed middle of November, was against a company called Surgical Care Affiliates, a unit of United Health. And that case was actually one of the earliest filed to trace back to 2021, but it kind of been in limbo under a motion to dismiss as a number of these other cases had moved forward and largely been rejected. And finally, the DOJ dropped it with basically no explanation. All they said was that it conserves court time and resources. And the DOJ has said nothing publicly about this. They haven't talked publicly about these cases in a couple of months generally, although it's pretty clear we haven't seen the last of them because as recently as September, the head of the DOJ Antitrust Division, Assistant Attorney General Jonathan Kanter, said, we are as committed as ever to, when appropriate, using our congressionally given authority to prosecute criminal violations in labor markets.
I just want to understand a little bit if you, and you did a really great feature for us on this kind of trend here, because as we've already, you've already hinted at this, but as a matter of law, I mean, it's sort of plainly illegal for companies to agree amongst each other not to compete for employees or to suppress wages. Like, I mean, that is outlined in antitrust law. So I am curious to know if there's a sense of why that has been such a hard case to make for a jury. Is it the sense that they're bringing cases that are too complicated, or it's not so cut and dry as the law allows? But what are you hearing?
It doesn't seem to be a question of complicated. It seems to, and the DOJ will be the first one to tell you, every case is decided on its own individual merits and the individual facts of that case. But a lot of times, especially these no-poach cases, lawyers also like to call them non-solicitation cases, because mm-hmm. it's not usually you and I won't hire each other's workers. It's you and I won't recruit each other's workers. So company A can't go to a worker at company B and say, hey, would you want to apply? So there has been, in many of these cases, there has been at least some mobility between the companies. So the argument being the market hasn't actually been allocated. There hasn't been a definitive inhibition on competition in the market because people are still moving. They're just maybe not getting recruitment letters.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting case because it's like, I mean, is the idea that then they're operating in some kind of gray area of the law where it's just like you're not actively recruiting, but like they're allowed to sort of seek it out on their own? I mean, yeah. What do you think on that?
Gray area is probably a good way to think about this because it comes down to the two different standards that the DOJ and FTC pursue antitrust cases. There's per se anti-competitive. What you're doing is illegal. Full stop. You and I agree to fix wages.
Yeah.
Period. Or more like fix prices, because the wage fixing is at least the way these cases have been going. It's harder
to prove.
But yeah. So the courts have treated three different classes of potentially anti-competitive conduct as per se. Historically, that's price fixing, it's market allocation, and it's bid rigging. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, it gets potentially squickier, and you get into the rule of reason. Rule of reason, you can actually say, what I did didn't really harm competition. It didn't, prices didn't actually go down. And maybe what I did was ancillary or otherwise related to and backing something that's a legitimate business conduct. And the DOJ, as a matter of policy, only pursues criminal prosecutions under the per se standard, which is a stricter standard. But judges have seemed to start balking at per se treatment for some of these cases. And they've also allowed, in at least sometimes, that kind of a justification for it to say, oh, this is part of, or at the very least, this isn't per se anti-competitive because it's not a per se allocation, as the judge said in Connecticut against a couple of engineering staffing executives.
All right. So it's interesting that the DOJ made this a priority, these labor side antitrust cases, and now they're facing this uphill battle and there have been, you know, losses and sort of like quiet dismissals. In the interviews you had with attorneys who are following this, I mean, is there a consensus on, is this type of prosecution, criminal prosecution anyway, is this like completely dead, or will it become a little more narrowly tailored or bespoke? Or, I mean, is there like any kind of forecast here on what lies ahead for labor side antitrust prosecution?
I think it's fairly clear we've not seen the last of these cases. The question is, what do they look like going forward? Because the only remaining labor side criminal prosecution is a wage fixing case. There are no more currently public no poach cases. There could be indictments under seal for all we know. And DOJ likes to say that they've got a huge volume of grand jury investigations ongoing. So there could be more of these cases in the future. And I think it's likely because of how high priority agency leadership has indicated these cases to be. What they look like going forward, I mean, I talked to a juror on a wage fixing case last year who voted to acquit. It was in the case where they did convict on lying to FTC investigators, but acquitted on everything else. And she said the evidence just wasn't there. She said that the defendant was extraordinarily lucky that there wasn't an explicit text confirming, yes, we are going to do this. And it was all around that and nothing as direct as the jury wanted. And she said she wanted to convict. And she was troubled by this potential.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, the idea that there is a not so explicit idea, but that you can't convict that under the law.
Yeah, she just didn't think the DOJ had met its burden of proof.
Yeah. I mean, again, I mean, there's more in the pipeline you're thinking. I mean, do people think this is like attorneys I'm talking about now? I mean, is this like falling down the ladder or anything? Or I mean, what's the outlook?
The defense bar hates these cases.
Yeah.
I mean, universally, I don't think I've talked to a single one who thinks that these are good, potentially legitimate sure. cases. They yeah. all argue that that especially no poach conduct should be considered rule of reason, should be pursued civilly, should not open people up to potentially spending time in prison because of the nuances that oftentimes there is mobility or wages don't actually go down as the DOJ said they would. And they say it's not as clear cut and that there could be legitimate reasons for this kind of conduct. And so it shouldn't be treated as market allocation as the DOJ has. Now, judges have so far allowed the cases to get past the motion to dismiss,
right.
saying the DOJ has made out a claim as unreasonable restraint of trade as a criminal violation. But lawyers that I've talked to, they all say that's the wrong litmus test. It's the wrong standard because motions to dismiss in criminal cases are very easy to beat. And juries have certainly shown that even if these cases are getting past the motion to dismiss, they're not getting to the finish line.
Yeah. It's a fascinating development, and I'm glad you were here to talk about it with us. Again, this is Law 360's own senior competition reporter, Brian Koenig, on the state of labor side antitrust enforcement. Thank you, Brian. Always great to have you on the show. And I thought it was a very enlightening conversation. So thanks again.
Always great to be here.
Guys, I think that'll wrap up today's show. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, it was a great show. We only do great shows, frankly, at this point. I did want to, it's kind of disingenuous to just say, yeah, great show. It's like they are all, it's like shrinks the compliment.
It's like choosing among your children. We love them all.
We love them all. I did want to flag a small news item that just came across my desk, literally as we were recording. I didn't know this. This is also Taylor Swift related. And I know there's been a lot of that of late, but listen,
Haley and I would say there's never too much.
Never too much?
We're tracking the zeitgeist. Did you guys know? So this just came out. The actress Mariska Hargitay, who is on Law & Order, which is why I'm talking about this. Of course, she's Detective Olivia Benson. Did you guys know that Taylor had named one of her cats Olivia Benson? Was this known?
No, I did not know that. Oh my God, I love it.
Yeah, well, that's not even news. Apparently, that was like already a thing. Olivia Benson, the cat, has her own Wikipedia page, which I just learned. But that, I guess, happened some years ago. But apparently, the new news this week is that Mariska Hargitay, who plays Olivia Benson, has a new cat, and she named it Karma after the Taylor Swift
wow.
song.
Wow. Okay.
And so, I mean, I wish this involved one of the actors who played a lawyer on Law & Order and not one of the cops, because I do like to keep it that way, but, you know.
Still legal.
We have a low bar for this part of the show.
I do like that if we're getting into like celebrity tit for tat behavior, that it is of this nature. This is great.
I will say the thing where you name a cat or a dog, any animal, a first and last name is very cool. Like,
yeah.
Just like mm-hmm. having a cat named Olivia Benson, regardless of it being, she's a character on Law & Order, obviously, Law & Order SVU. And I just, I have tremendous respect for that. And I find Taylor Swift like often very corny, but I have to commend her on that.
I think that's very good. And naming pets is really hard. I have a dear friend who just got a new dog and like sent the cute puppy picture and was like bouncing around names before they decided. And it's difficult. A lot of the names suggested were food related. And yeah. The best one I came up with was to name the dog Queso and call it Casey for short. But it was rejected. This was widely rejected. But that's the best I could do.
Spanish for cheese, you mean?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Because the dog was like a little bit that color. I technically suggest Queso Blanco because it did look like the dog. And this particular friend was a Spanish major in college. I thought it was perfect. Again, it was considered no bueno, widely rejected.
No bueno.
That's a shame. See, my cat came to me with her current name. Yeah. The shelter named her Fig. And I was like, that's fine. The only thing I did tweak was Los Angeles listeners will know there's an iconic neighborhood establishment in Los Feliz where I live called Figaro Bistro. And I happen to be a regular there. And I decided that Fig's full legal name should be Figaro Bistro.
Yeah. Wow.
So very good.
I updated her microchip to like her legal name to be Figaro Bistro Knopf.
Her government name. That's nice. Yeah.
So I can call her Bistro for short, you know.
Very good. I'll never have a chance to mention this on the show other than in this space where we've drifted to pet names. I do want to just say there was a guy I knew a couple of years ago who had a basset hound and his name and the basset hound was named Jeff. And I thought that was just like the most hilarious human name you could ever give to a pet. His name was Jeff. He had a bed. Flawless. It said Jeff on it. And I was just like, I just
Was that Jeff
it.
With a G or a J?
No, it was
That's
a J.
A good question. Okay. The traditional Jeff.
I'm just making sure.
The canonical J. J-E-F-F. Anyway, Taylor's out here naming cats. Mariska Hargitay's out here naming cats. We're all naming cats. And dogs.
We are.
Honestly, what a joy, guys. This was a great way to end today's show. And thank you, Alex, for bringing that to us.
Yeah. Hey, listen, I'm out. During recordings, I'm finding stories. So
you're
out
here consuming. The intrepid journalist you are.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Wow. Yes.
Consuming content while creating content.
Happy to do so. Thank you, Amber.
And thanks a lot, Haley.
Thank you.
We also want to thank our producers, Kelly Marcano and Stephen Trader, our guest this week, Brian Koenig, and our contributing reporters, Cara Salvatore and Craig Clough. Music for the show comes from Silent Partner and Kelly Marcano. If you like Pro Se, give us 5 stars and a written review. That will definitely help other people find our show. And if you want to read more about anything we've talked about, go to our website. That's law360.com/podcast. Thanks, and see you back here next week.